Welcome back. It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. What is rhetoric, you ask? And I say, what isn't rhetoric? Everything's rhetoric simply because human beings craft messages as we try to communicate to each other. And rhetoric is about consciously crafting messages to make them more effective. Been studied for a long time. I do it formally. That's what my PhD is in. Most people do it informally. They sort of use the theories that they've come up with or things they've learned from their jobs or experience and how to persuade other people. The podcast tries to teach people a little bit more formal training. I interview rhetoricians on here and academics and persuasion professionals. I talk to people who have social issue activism because they're trying to use messaging to get things done. And I talk to comedians because they're always fun to hear about their politics. And finally, I bring on conservatives to convert them, because the right worries me. And if that statement concerns you at all, then come on to the show and we'll talk about it. Because I like talking to the right. Today's another episode, I guess, of persuasion professionals and social activists. Kind of, right? So we'll figure it out. This is different. I've never done this before. This is a podcast on my podcast. So I was on these guys' podcast last week, an American Conversation, and they asked me a lot of questions about rhetoric, as people tend to do. And we told some jokes, and then Rose cornered me after the podcast in a good way, Zoom cornered me, zornered me. I don't know, something that to talk about trans issues. And that's one of her social activist areas. And we talked about it for a while. And I was like, you know what? You should come on and talk about that, because there's a lot there. So real quickly, Rose Medina is the host and co-host of the podcast. I'm going to start with her, and then my other two guests are going to introduce themselves, and off we'll go. Here we go.
You started the conversation on the trans issue when you mentioned Dave Chappelle.
I did was trigger you. I did not start a conversation.
Oh, is that what it was? Yeah, no, it's right. You did trigger me. So I just finished the conversation.
Yes, you did.
You triggered me. Okay, all right. So my name's Rose Medina. My background is I'm a social worker. I was licensed in New York State, worked with victims of crime, worked with predators, I like to call them, sexual predators, ran some groups. Then I moved out to California, dabbed into improv at the Groundlings, love comedy. I'm a wannabe comic. I'm not that good at it, but I'm trying. And I love people. That's why I started the podcast. And I love women, though I'm not a lesbian. I wish I was.
I would be dating
Ex-Atlantic right now if I was. Yeah, totally. She would be my woman. But unfortunately, I like penis. Yeah.
Yeah. Just cursed by God to like penis.
I know. Cursed by the goddess to like penis. Yes.
Yeah. Dick addiction. That's, yeah.
That I don't have, but I have dick-like. Yeah.
The other thing you need to know is, like, I'm also a comedian. I'm a late night comedy writer. I wrote for Dennis Miller and Letterman, and I do stand up. So a lot of this podcast, it's freewheeling. You can say whatever you want. There's no limits, and a lot of it would be jokes too. So, all right, that's Rose Medina.
Can I I can say you can't say addiction without shun.
That's true.
I messed that joke up, didn't I?
Right. Something about shunning dicks was in there, though.
Thank you. Something like that. Yeah. This is why I'm not a comedian.
But it had the raw materials. You saw the raw materials.
No, I think the tee up was strong. The delivery was weak. But I'll keep working at it.
All right, there you go. So that makes you a writer. You can't actually deliver the jokes.
There you go.
So who's next?
Go ahead, Ex-Atlantic.
All right. My name's Ex-Atlantic. That's what I go by on these strange times we're in. I'm a speech pathologist, by trade. So I spend my day job just helping people learn how to communicate at all. And then when I'm not doing that, I've been a content creator, making videos, looking at various angles of the gender ideology movement. The trans rights movement, especially first person narratives of discussing the outcome of the surgeries. So I find people discussing their aftermath and the nightmare complications they very predictably get. And then otherwise talk about different kind of schools of thought within gender ideology, because I have a bachelor's in gender and women's studies, and how there's multiple incoherent models of what is gender, what is gender identity, what does that concept mean? But there's not a lot of awareness of the fact that there are multiple schools of thought about it that are incoherent. So we're in a situation where people are kind of getting people jumping down their throat for not knowing what the person they talk to believes. And the person they're talking to is not aware of the fact that other people actually do believe different things.
That sounds about right. That sounds like a good overview of the morass of gender and identity that's going on right now. I have lots of stuff to talk about with that. All right. And our final headband guest, our second headband of the night.
My name is Derek Duvall. I have a master's in communication studies from the University of North Carolina. That was in the dim and distant past. The last quarter century I spent building and running a technology company that has now sunsetted, and I am now who wanders with purpose. I'm going back to the school of life. Love to listen to people who are a lot smarter than I am talk about things that I find really interesting. And I've taken a particular interest over the past year in what I feel like is sort of the unfortunate underbelly of wokeness gone too far, in particular with gender identity ideology. And I'm very interested in how language creates reality, and how those who control the language control the narrative. And I think there's a lot to unpack there as relates to social justice movements in general, and certainly gender identity ideology in particular.
There you go. See, all you guys are sort of throwing horseshoes into snake pits. There's all sorts of stuff going on in these areas. What started all this was I had said, somehow we got on Dave Chappelle on the podcast, and I said, I think Chappelle's a brilliant comedian, but he's out of his lane when he's talking about trans and LBQT and issues. Like, I don't go to that guy to hear his opinions on those cultures. And he's even said that he made a living for 30 years by doing race commentary, and clearly has a strong perspective in that. But even that's grounded, like, in his version of race theory. Like, he's not from the South. I don't remember where Chappelle's from. I associate him with like New York and that area.
No, I think he's from Ohio.
Oh, maybe he's from Ohio.
Yeah, he's a Midwesterner.
Okay. So he didn't grow up in the South, and I grew up on the border of the South, half South, Kentucky. And so I have a different understanding of a lot of that stuff than he did, but I think he has value there, clear value, like even as bigger than just a comedian. He has clear value, and people want to assign more value to comedians than just funny. They want to import other things to them. It's not really fair to the comedian, but I said he was out of his lane, and I don't get into that lane. I don't go into that lane as an expert, and that triggered Rose. So talk about
it triggered me because I think he has a right to his opinion, whether he's in that lane or not. And it was his perspective. You know,
right, he didn't have the right to say it. I said I didn't expect it to have much value.
I think it does, because he had a trans woman friend who committed suicide after he was attacked for his opinions.
That's a rhetoric move. His big, you know, heartrending story at the end of that. If you watch Chappelle, he's got a few things like that he'll use, you know, sort of a heartfelt story within his stand-up. And that's a rhetoric move. That's clearly a pathos move. To get people on your side because you've lost somebody and you tell it in a narrative way. That's not really stand up. Like, it didn't really belong in that show. Like, he jumped out of his frame, out of his lane, and started using other rhetoric, which if he's going to do, fine. But now he's going to be judged over there. He's not going to be judged as a comedian anymore.
Well, I think good comedy can do a lot of different things. You know, I mean, and it depends on what the audience is looking for from comedy, right? I mean, there's certain people that are going to like Andrew Dice Clay because they think dirty nursery rhymes are funny. It's like Hickory Dickory Dock. This girl was sucking my cock. I don't personally think that's very funny, but some people eat it up, right?
Where did you get that, man? That's good material.
Yeah, well, there you go. And then,
he stole that from a street puppet in New York.
Andrew Dice Clay did.
Yeah. There's a famous, street puppet act named Otto and somebody, and he was doing those, he did all those jokes, and Andrew Dice Clay just stole them. So you can hate him even more.
Yeah. Well, it's,
he's stealing from puppets.
It's kind of a throwaway example of the kind of comedy that, you know, and I'm not judging. I mean, if you think that shit's funny, then knock yourself out. I think Chappelle is a social commentator who uses comedy to deliver really important messages, mostly about race. And I think the episode that we're talking about was really about race, not about gender identity. I think he used the trans narrative to expose and contrast what I find is a kind of ridiculous victimization stance amongst many people who feel that to be trans identified is to be reviled and persecuted. And there's the scene in The Closer where, you know, he's got his fictitious, you know, Clifford on either side of him, and he's got the trans person who's bemoaning, you know, how discriminated against they are. And he, you know, Chappelle does the whole like, Clifford, you got anything you want to say about this? I mean, basically to compare, you know, hundreds of years of oppression and slavery to this very recent sort of explosion of trans-identified people who actually, and I believe Chappelle's point was, want to appear powerless, but powerful. And I'm curious, Dan, about your take on this, because I think this is where the language and controlling the narrative and the rhetoric of the trans movement is incredibly clever and savvy at getting attention and deflecting reasonable arguments and basically trying to establish, you know, an ideology as fact when the truth is it basically has just appeared really in the past several decades. So that's a mouthful, but that was my take on what Chappelle was trying to do.
Yeah. So I'm going to get excellentic.
Excellentic. Yeah.
Hey, did I get close? Was I close?
Yeah. It's more of an ash on the land. So it's like excellentic.
Do people call you X?
Yeah, people do.
All right. I'm from Kentucky. So you're going to have to give me some, you know, articulation break.
Sure.
I want to get your response to that. The first, before I do, I want to say, like, what you launched with, you sort of, and this happens all the time in logic, like logos and rhetoric is, you know, all the rationality, all the logic, all the rules for that, which nobody ever gets taught. And so people argue at the speed of modern life and they just buzz through like 80 claims in 5 minutes. And then you're like, okay, what did they even say? Mm-hmm. So you launched with, you know, comedians can do important things. By definition, comedians are not important. Comedians are not a source of information. They're not a source of insight. They are doing fake insight, fake information, because they're playing mechanical tools with comedy. And I know they look genius. I know they look smart, but I can show you the mechanical processes which make them look smart, like things like inverting. So if you just do this little thing with a rhetorical tool, which is with the language, you take something and you flip it, it makes it comic and it seems really smart. But all you did was a comic technique. So by definition, if comedy exists as a frame, and this is just a theory, again, you can argue against this, then saying comedians need to do more important things, that's not part of my perspective on comedy. I think comedy is there to make you laugh. If you don't laugh, fine. If you do laugh, great. Go find a different comedian. But judging it beyond that, it's really tricky. All right, X, mm-hmm. What'd you think about that? What was your reaction to that summary he had about The Closer and Chappelle?
So I haven't seen the Chappelle stand-up that you guys are discussing, although I've heard about it. I feel like a comedy can be a vehicle to get people to pay attention. So in my videos, I use a lot of jokes because I feel like otherwise the subject matter itself is so horrible that people would turn off. They would just tune out. So you need to just kind of keep giving them the feedback of the reinforcement to keep watching of the joke. So they keep watching to get to the jokes, but maybe you wouldn't classify me as a comedian. Maybe I'm just an educator that uses comedy and it's different from being a comedian.
Yeah. I think that as a tool, everybody uses comedy. Everybody uses humor. Everybody likes to laugh. Again, like my thing is like when you move it over into professional comedy, do you want frames around your rhetoric is the question. And this is kind of what, again, sent Rose off. She's like, I'm like, well, I don't get in those lanes very often because I'm not an expert. Like I literally have no experience outside of my daughter did a special effects makeup and beauty makeup when she was a teenage in Austin. And she did a lot of free work for the trans community for drag shows. And she used to constantly, we'd talk about it. I'd take her to shows and things like that. And she'd constantly try to teach me. And I'm like, it's not getting in.
I just don't care.
Well, it's not that I don't care. It's just, that's not my community. It's not my issue. I've got many, many issues. But if she had been trans or if it was something right there in my world, I would have learned a lot more about it. So I like frames. I like lanes. I think they're useful.
Can I comment on that?
Yeah.
I think I am part of that community because they say trans women are women. And I'm a woman. So I'm part of the community of women. So I feel that it's okay for me to have an opinion on it, even though to some people, I would think that I was out of my lane. But as a woman born, I feel like I can say something positive. It doesn't have to be negative, but to have an opinion on it. So yeah, that's all I have to say.
Well, and again, to be clear, like none of this is me saying you need to anybody needs to be restricted in what they say. I don't care. Like I'm talking about optimizing people's rhetoric. That's kind of my, you know, what I do in life. And to me, like I know I'm going to not be very effective outside of my particular lanes. And so I just don't go out there. Like I'll give you an example. They have this euphemism for black nights at comedy clubs that they've used forever. They call them urban nights. And so a mostly white dominated comedy club will every once in a while have a urban night. And I was working in North Carolina not long after I'd started in comedy, and they didn't tell me they were going to do it. But on Thursday night, it was 250 African-American couples in the audience. And I have no comedy that fits that culture. And so I went up and I kind of played around a little bit first and they were laughing. And then I started into my regular material and they just stared at me. And afterwards, one of the guys from the show came up and was like, you know, you should talk more about black and white issues. I'm like, yeah, I probably shouldn't because I really don't know how to turn that into comedy without just offending people. I don't know where the landmines are. And for a comedian, that's usually a bad thing.
You should have gotten that one black friend that everybody has. What's wrong with you?
Well, look what Dave Chappelle did. I've got this one trans friend. I mean, it's literally the same trope.
But he has it right. We have, you know, freedom of speech. Why not?
Yeah, I'm not saying you can say whatever you want, but it's unoptimized speech. And rhetoric wants optimized speech. I want the experts. I want to hear the people who are really good at explaining this, not the whole massive avalanche of weak opinions and non-direct experience. David, do you have direct experience with this issue?
Sorry, you lost me there. Direct experience
with the thing you were talking about earlier, like the victimization stance of the, you know, trans community.
No, not direct. Just my the last couple of years, I've done a lot of reading and research, and I've been involved in a couple of organizations that are raising awareness about the dangers of gender ideology, specifically as it applies to the medicalization of youth and young adults. And so that's, you know, and when you dip a toe into that world, you very quickly become a target for people who feel like it is, you know, verboten to say anything that suggests that this concept of gender identity is anything other than authentic and immutable. I think the, there's a lot that you could unpack here, but one of the things that I know is a controversial idea, and I'll just put it out there because I'd be interested in your reactions to it. But, you know, there's been an explosion of trans-identified youth in the past 10 years, okay? And some people would like to say, well, and that has happened is that there's been, they've always been there, but now there's this societal acceptance. And if that were the case, then that societal acceptance, wouldn't that also be encouraging all the trans-identified people in their 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s to also come out in similar numbers? Mm-hmm. And that hasn't happened. Instead, so
you just did a logos move there, right? You did an if then, like a logic move. If this were true, it should also apply to this other population. And you're going to use that to discredit the claim.
Well,
that's fine. I'm just, like I said, I unpack the rhetoric.
Okay, no, so you're describing rhetorical techniques, and I'm sitting there thinking, did you just say that what I said didn't make sense? Because what I said does make perfect sense.
No, it can be put together rationally. You can follow a logos trail, and it was very rational what you said. That doesn't mean it's correct. And by the way, when I do stuff like this, it's not to tell you that you're incorrect or to criticize the way you talk, because that's what happens a lot of times with communication professionals. They'll find unoptimized communication and they'll comment on it and people feel attacked. I'm trying to optimize your rhetoric so that if you do want to make this argument to difficult populations, not to populations that already agree with you, then you need to know where all the flaws are in your argument. And so that's okay. All I'm trying to do for people.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting and it's helpful. Well, to wrap back to the original thought is one way to explain how it is that so many young people and particularly natal females have adopted a trans identity in the past decade is if you look at these teenage years and the population of people that are often identifying as trans, and you look at what I feel like is a vulnerability during those years of identification, of discomfort with the body, of what happens when you reach puberty, of what it's like to be a young woman in a society where there's always been difficulty for young women, you know, as they mature and become sexual beings, and as they become, you know, whether they want the sexual attention from men or not, there's just a whole lot that happens during those years. And it's a particularly vulnerable population. And I think the other issue with young males.
Let me jump in a little bit because monologues, like in podcast monologues, end up being kind of hard to listen to. And not that, again, you're making sense. It's all good. I just want to get everybody involved. X, what do you have to say at this point? Pick something. Pick out of all the things flying around in the air.
Well, I mean, you had asked the other two whether they had experience with this topic. And so when I was in college, I was identifying as trans when I first encountered it, when I was in the gender and women's studies program. So I was pretty deep in the community for a while. And I went to college at UC Berkeley, which is where Judith Butler teaches. And so I was like deep in it, really deep. And I was in school. This is like 2009, 2010. And then I went to a different school for graduate school and was still involved with the LGBT Center. And it wasn't until like 2015 that the pronoun stuff came onto my radar and the non-binaries. So it's just I hate to say the word journey. I make fun of how often they use the word journey in my videos. I play a little like whip sound every time somebody says it, and there's a little journey counter. So if you watch Boston Children's Hell is the name of that series. It's a response to five doctors at Boston Children's Hospital discussing what I've termed their healthy child sex lobotomy experiments. It's really, it'll make your skin crawl, but there is a journey counter for comic relief.
That's funny. Yeah. I mean, all these things become so complicated so quickly. And that's kind of what I was saying. A rhetorician will sit back and listen to people making arguments. And the only way for me to give you a decent response is to start pulling out claims, attaching it to evidence, judging the quality of that, you know, so that you can offer rebuttals, and then setting up a warrant that says this is now qualified to make a conclusion from. And nobody argues that way. They don't even do it when they set up the arguments by themselves. Like think of it as a continuum. There are expressive humans and we are all expressive humans. You don't think about what you're going to say. You just say it. You know, you may have thought about it before, but you express. And over here is a rhetorician who will not let a single message out of their mouth before they do really good work on it because they want it to be super effective. And I find in these really complex issues like this, there's just so many sites of conflict and potential failure. Like the semantics, you know, the problem right now is there are only two terms in the existing English language for gender that have been normalized over thousands of years. And suddenly we're like, you know, we kind of need more. Like it seems like things have gotten more complicated, but artificially creating terms is unnatural semantics that doesn't work. Especially when they have no stability. And when, like you were saying at the beginning, they move around across the community. So you get all this confusion, all this irritation, and all this conflict, but it's a semantic conflict.
And the word was already invented. It's called personality. And then your sex is binary. You're either male or female. That's it. It was already invented. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. So that's what...
What does that mean? Explain that, because that definition means no,
wheel?
That definition makes no sense to me.
Which one?
Personality versus gender.
Because there's no gender means sex. That's why Ginsburg created it, because men could not tolerate the word sex when she was doing some kind of argument in the Supreme Court. She came up with the word gender, which I think in Greece means sex. It's one of those countries. So she brought that to the consciousness of language, probably the 60s or 70s, but it means sex, and sex is binary.
Allen Ginsberg created gender?
No. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, sorry. And she came up with it because men were like giggling, I'm sure, you know, and she said sex, you know. Kind of like in Family Guy, when somebody farts, everybody giggles. So she used the term, changed it to gender. So now it's been co-opted. And the way I feel like it's been co-opted, and I know it's a feeling, is that it's personality. It's people should just be allowed to be who they are.
The personality is already taken as a word. It doesn't mean gender. Personality is gender.
But what does gender mean to you?
I don't know. I haven't really thought about it.
It means category.
Category.
Yeah. So it comes from the same root as a word like genera or genre. It's the same root. It's a category. And so in the gendered wars, you know, people use it in a few different ways. One meaning of gender is things like an ad hoc collection of secondary things like femininity. We would call that a gender, but that's not how some of them are using the word gender. Some people also use the word gender to talk about the sex, age, species intersection of adult, female, human. So therefore woman is the gender. That's how some people got to woman being a gender, whereas other people, femininity would be the gender. And so there's multiple definitions for this word that are currently in use that are incompatible. And then so the people that want to say that gender is the adult, female, human, the reason they want to say that a lot of times is because they're trying to make room for male women. Like their goal is for there to be male women that are defined as women based on looking like women. But a woman is not anyone who looks like a woman. That's not a meaningful definition of something.
Exactly.
Gold is not anything that looks like gold. Fool's gold is.
Amen. I love listening to excellent.
Fool's women? Is that what it is then? They're fools, what? Women?
Yeah, basically. more or less.
And again, like if you get into semantic theory, you know, the very basic thing that you learn, first of all, that kind of blows your mind is that the words don't work. There's way more slippage in words than there is accuracy in words. Like you can take any term and like, I sometimes when I teach comm theory, I start by saying the word dog. I'm like, okay, everybody knows what that is. Nobody here has the dog in their head that I have in my head. Mm. I promise you, because it was a dog I grew up with. His name was Pooch. Mm-hmm. And he was crazy. But that word functioned and we would have just flown right past it if I'd used it in a sentence, but it literally it's impacted with like 500 different meanings. And so it's an illusion that we have control of the language, which would allow us to control the argument, which would allow us to control reality, like you were saying, David, like the construction of reality. There's a lot of stuff in rhetoric about the linguistic construction of reality, but everybody gets this weird, quick idea that that means that they can now participate in the linguistic construction of reality. Whereas like the organic theory of language says, no, this was all here before you. You're never going to get out of it. You can move around in the storm some, but you're never going to reset reality because that's baked into the organic language. And so whenever you're fighting against organic language, you know, and the limits of organic language, it's a really tough battle. And you see all these kind of, you know, massive conflicts over small terms like woman. You know, that the Congress has been doing this with. Well,
you can call it a small term, but it's actually really important that we have a
it's massive
woman that's rooted in sex, because we have this thing called the 19th Amendment, and the 19th Amendment protects women's rights to vote on the basis of our sex. And so if you separate sex from the idea of womanhood, if you say that sex is meaningless and not real, not a real distinction, the way that the ACLU is currently saying in California, they're saying that we should put men in women's prisons because there's no difference between males and females. It's just a myth. Well, if we don't have that idea in law, then what is protecting women's right to vote? Everyone's taking it for granted that the Supreme Court is not going to decide that women don't have the right to vote before November. I'm not taking that for granted. With the way where things are going, it seems like both the right and the left wants to redefine women as not a real category, and therefore there's nothing stopping them from criminalizing voting if you have a uterus, because you might hurt a fetus or something, because it's no longer related to sex. It's no longer related to being a woman.
Exactly.
Yeah, and when I say small term, I don't mean unimportant term. Okay. I mean like the crazy amount of things in there. Like you just added in the legalized definition of woman, mm-hmm. which is a whole new area of rhetoric. You know, versus the cultural definitions across all these cultures across time, that word is horribly unstable across all the times and places where it's used. It has no clear definition.
Not to us.
I don't know. I feel like it's always been adult female humans, because femaleness is older than humanity. We've been females longer than we've been humans.
Right. So the organic language boiled this up and said, yeah, here you go. Organic, whatever you said as your definition, seems to be the predominant definition we've used. But now that's getting complicated. David, you had something to say.
Well, yeah. Well, just, you know, back to your example with dog, Dan, you know, when you say dog, we all get a different image of a dog in our mind, but we don't get an image of an aardvark or a giraffe. Or, you know,
I don't know that
because that'd be super weird. Maybe some people do, but the point is, when we say woman, I don't know. I mean, this is where it gets dangerous, because if you say woman, then yeah, there are obviously we can have many different images of what a woman is, but it's really important to have agreed upon of what it really means to be a woman, because of the
what's agreed upon, who's agreeing to this.
Well, women. This is a great question, because I think, I mean, let's agree that sex is binary, that women produce large gametes and men produce small gametes. That's a great way to tell the difference. We've had billions of years of sperm and eggs.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've had billions of years of evolution that have fine-tuned.
Oh, but you're not a vet, but you know what a dog is.
I'm going to take you aside after the podcast and explain sperm to you. But for right now.
You know, one thing I can predict is you will not do that. I can predict that won't happen.
Right, no. They can swim a long way.
I was waiting for you to rip me a new one on the rhetoric there. But yeah, you know, so I think, you know, the English language is fascinating, and I'm sure there are examples in every every human language, you know, then, and there's, for example, the word set, which I think there may be 40 different meanings of the English language for that word. And then, you know, you have the word fall, which, you know, has two very different meanings. There's a season and then there's an action of something that's dropping, you know, and there's so, you know, so we, and we normalize this confusion and this complexity with these types of words. But when it comes down to fundamental people's rights based on their sex, this whole movement toward blurring the lines and making it seem as if sex is a spectrum, I think has real dangers. You know,
well, it has implications. Dangers is kind of a loaded word.
Well, I'll give you an example of danger. Exelancic already talked about, you know, the potential.
I'm not saying you can't find me examples of dangers. I'm just saying you launched in with that verb, you know, or that, you know, description. And I'm like,
let me follow danger with this then. Are you aware that there are bona fide examples of women being raped in prison by biological males who have claimed a female gender identity in order to be reassigned into female units? So picture this, a male sexual predator, a guy with a dick who's in prison for having raped people, says, oh, actually, my gender identity is female, gets reassigned
into female prisons. All right, so you give me a very outrageous example.
Again, it's a real example. I'll get you the same
thing right now in my
show notes.
Right. I'm not saying this doesn't happen. I'm saying out of all the things that happen, you're plucking one that has a lot of energy in it. A lot of villainy.
Okay. Well, I'll give you villainy, but aren't these edge examples the things that we need to, I mean, thank God happening, you know, all day, every day, everywhere. But these are very real violations of women's rights in places that should be women's safe spaces. And if we're blurring this definition of what it means to be a man or a woman, and people can have this magical ideology, this immutable feeling that they are not one, or that they're, you know, internally, they're somehow, you know, a different gender from their biological sex. Well, I, you know, if they're not bothering anybody and they're living their life and being kind and respectful, then great. I support people's beliefs and whatever they want to do. It's fine. I mean, I'm sure I do a lot of things people think are weird, and that's fine too. But when it comes to the point where people are claiming that sex is not binary and that gender identity is somehow immutable and intrinsic and undeniable, it's untestable, and they're using that in order to infringe on other people's rights, then it's a big problem.
Yeah, and those are strong. Those are strong rhetorics on their side. Like, you're picking again, sort of the extreme rhetorics of, you know, the idea that this is immutable, that we define it, like it, you can't question it. And this is what the left gets attacked for, is not keeping the discussion open, because they're typically, you know, there's, so in narrative theory, there's hero, villain, victim, and stakeholder. This is the best way to think about this stuff from a rhetoric perspective. Get it out of logic, because you're going to lose.
Prey? The opposite of victim is predator, prey. It's not, what did you say? State something?
Stakeholder, like an interested party, but they're not directly involved, right? So hero, villain, victim, interested parties.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
All right.
I'm learning.
Yeah. And that's, like I said, that's kind of what I do on the podcast. So you're picking villains, people who are misusing, you know, using this as cover to pull off horrible acts to other human beings. And who would be the hero in this story? Like, the people come in and stop this from happening and redefine the everything so that it's clean and clear, and that you can keep these people from doing that? Like,
yes.
So
the government, that's what the state, the government does. That's why we have laws that are sex-based.
So really good laws would be the hero. You guys are just stakeholders.
Yeah, the legislation that feminists fought for. Legislation like Title IX, which the Biden administration is directing schools to force women and girls to disrobe in front of men and boys, as long as they say, I'm a woman too. You know, they have a Title IX right to be free of a sexually hostile environment. But if you get rid of the idea of sex differences, how do you define sexually hostile? It's not meaningful anymore. So we're just throwing out women's and girls' protections with no consideration for what that impact is going to be.
Right. Just like David pulled out an extreme example, you just pulled out an extreme example for me of women disrobing in front of, you know,
that's what happens when you let boys compete on the girls' team.
I totally get it.
In the locker room.
But you guys,
that's what happens.
Rhetoric wise, you're going to lose people when you pull out extreme examples and make them representative. It's a rhetorical flaw.
The president directed schools to do this. The president generally.
There's no way that Joe Biden said, hey, what I want you all to do, what I want you all to do is have girls strip down in front of all the boys and everything and test. He never said that.
Are you following the line? Yep.
He never, those words have never exited his mouth. He may not have talked about
it that way, but that's what happens. That's what
happens. No, he may have talked about the law.
Girls to change. Have you been following the Liar Thomas situation at UPenn?
No, I don't follow how
all of his. Okay, well, his female teammates.
I'm doing rhetoric with you guys. I'm not doing content.
They forced them. As a condition of competing on the swim team, they forced the female students to disrobe in front of the male students and to be near the male student when he was disrobed as well. And you know, they have come out and said that this is a really making obviously everyone uncomfortable because he's still fully intact and fully responsive. So it's
I don't know.
It's definitely happening.
It's just an extreme example.
No, but you said to me, and it triggered me too, you said I wasn't an expert. So I brought two people that are experts at this. They are. So, but now you're telling her she's not in her lane. This is her lane.
That's not what I said. That this is unoptimized rhetoric. Like if you want to, depends on who you're trying to persuade. Like if you're persuading, you know, I don't know where you guys sit on these issues. I have not done a background research to see where you guys are. I know Rose is, I kind of intimate that she's anti-medical transitions.
Yes, I'm anti-medical transition of children. You are an adult, you can do whatever you want. I don't care.
Okay. So that's a specific claim area. Like that's something I can actually talk about and do logical rhetoric on. But all I'm trying to do, like as this stuff is coming at me and you guys are steeped in it, clearly, you know, you've thought about this a lot, but the content doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is the rhetoric. Like, are you being effective with the audience you want to persuade? And some of the things that you're pulling out, I've heard from both sides, extreme examples, are a rhetorical flaw.
I think it sounds extreme to you, but it's actually happening. And so I'm not sure what we're supposed to do.
Actually happening doesn't make it representative.
It is representative of what's actually happening, though.
Exactly.
All right. So, in rhetoric, sure there's
evidence you would need.
There's six things we need in logic. I get you guys to use. There's claims, evidence, rebuttals, qualifiers, which is what we're having a problem with right now, warrants, and conclusions. So your qualifier, you're asking me to take that example, you know, as evidence, and then to add it into the entire frame. Like say, this is happening, this is representative. Are you saying that more schools in the country are doing that than not doing that? Or is that like one out of 10,000?
All schools have been directed to do that is what I'm saying. Literally all schools have been directed by the Biden administration to do this on pain of losing their funding.
There's no way that law says that.
It was one of the first things he did when he got into office.
Exactly. It was the first
executive
order. It's not the law. It's an executive order. You're right. It's not the law. The law is Title IX. The law says that females have rights. But Biden administration is saying that schools need to consider males female if they say they're female. That's why feminists are so mad. Because then we can't measure women's equality anymore. We can't measure how many opportunities are for the females. We can't measure how much funding is going to the females if you allow males to say they're female and you start putting males on the female team.
It's a biological issue.
Can I just say something? We're also, in terms of measuring, we can't measure crime either because now they're saying women are sex offenders. There was a case in the UK, a couple. Mm-hmm. A woman was arrested for having 300,000 images of children, and it was a trans woman. So now they're saying just women instead of saying trans women. Because then we know they're men originally. But that's another issue. We can't measure anything.
Yeah,
they're just blurring the lines. And that is dangerous. As somebody who worked with domestic violence survivors and victims of crime, I think it's dangerous. Even
there's that word again,
men.
Dangerous.
Of course, I worked with victims of crime. What am I going to call it? Lightweight violence?
No, escalation word. So oh, when, is you guys, it? Oh, okay. Yeah, when you guys want to escalate your story, you throw in a word like dangerous or this is happening everywhere. You know, and inflammatory rhetoric is inflammatory rhetoric. It's not that you're accurate or inaccurate, but you're making a choice right there to inflame the issue, inflame the discussion. Is that going to be effective with the people you're trying to talk to? Now, if you already have people who are already thinking everything's dangerous.
I'm not trying to talk to ideologues. I'm definitely not trying to talk to ideologues. I'm trying to talk to the mushy metal that's a little ignorant on what's going on.
Sure. And I think the Biden thing, you'd like to have a say in that, it sounds like.
More than a say, I'd like the Biden administration to recognize that females have the right to single sex spaces and single sex accommodations and to learn in a environment free of sexual hostility, sex discrimination, and sexual harassment.
Yeah, that's a great claim. That's a great, that's what I want. Now, is my rhetoric getting me that? David, go ahead.
Well, no, I think it's interesting because, who are we trying to convince, right? I mean, who is the audience? And I don't know how to answer that. I mean, I think the cultural current behind the support of gender identity ideology is incredibly strong. I think there's a lot of pluralistic ignorance behind it. I think, if
inflammatory word.
Ignorance. Well, let me explain what I mean by pluralistic ignorance. Okay. I think a lot of people believe that it must be true because other people seem to believe it's true, right? But I think when it comes right down to it, it doesn't feel genuine and doesn't feel like, I think it's a head scratcher for people. They're like, wow, where did this come from? Like, this is just like, it's just massive all of a sudden. There's what really is going on here? But because you cannot, quote unquote, speak about it without being silenced, and people are losing their jobs and people are, being doxxed as a result of, even saying, what was the recent one? There's the Jason Aldean. Is that the country guy whose girlfriend said something about how she was glad that transition didn't exist when she was a tomboy because she might've, she might've transitioned and now she's happy to be a woman. And, she got hated on so hard and Jason Aldean's publicist dropped him. And, so these are just one example of what happens, when people actually try to discuss this. So who are we trying to reach? I mean, I'm trying to reach the rational, reasonable person who's been scratching their head and thinking this doesn't feel right. What? There's something more complicated going on here than that suddenly there were a gazillion trans youth and we just didn't know it.
Well, yeah. Think of it again. I'll pull you back into theory this time. So what's happened with us now is that we've created a new kind of communication universe with digital. So there's private life. And like, if you were talking to me one-on-one, you could say, I'm trying to get Dan to understand this perspective from my, from the way I see it. You could be trying to get me to do something. You could be trying to get me to, if I have connections in the Biden administration, you'd be like, would you let me, you could be trying to do something personally. And in private space, persuasion and argument and things like that, especially with people that are typically rational, isn't that traumatic. It's fairly, you can control it for the most part. Public space over here, which has forever been reserved for the rich, and the powerful are the only ones who could ever get to public space. Like Trump would have never gotten on Cronkite, every day for 9 or 20 statements. What's happened with digital is it's created this mixy public-private world. So you'll be saying something, like David, in your private space, put it online and suddenly, you're going to be swamped by all these people who have bad arguments, good arguments, weird responses. It's a multi-log conversation. It's unnatural. Human beings can't do it. We are not designed to talk to 50,000 people. It just doesn't work. And so you're getting all these weird, cancellation, it works within that weird digital space that's undefined right now. And it'll evolve where rules kind of get in there and get more sophisticated about it. Like we've started to cull people out of the digital space when they get beyond a certain type of rhetoric, like violence encouraging and things like that. There's been some
violence encouraging these days is so absurdly close to nonviolence. I mean, just having an expressing an opinion that trans women are men, that's considered to be promoting violence, because on the theory that like people attack trans women because they're not women. So if we all just like lied to ourselves and lied to each other about whether they're women, nobody would attack them anymore. It's a very superstitious movement that's rooted in an attempt to placate their own mental illness symptoms like anxiety. They don't want to have to actually take responsibility for that.
Yeah, like I said, the middle space, you are dealing with people who have mental illnesses. Like you watch all the Karen videos. Those are clearly mentally ill people. Mm. You know, that can't control.
No, they're racist or something. They're not mentally ill.
It doesn't matter what they're picking. If it was race in this video, the next one would be somebody's too fat. They're just going off because they have a problem. They have a mental issue. And we're looking at it like, villains, villains, villains. But if they move over to victim, like as somebody that's just mentally ill, they escape all the cancel. You know, so what are they? Again, it always comes back in rhetoric, comes back to definitions.
Not today. They don't get, if you're a victim in America today, you're revered. It seems to me, I could be wrong.
Well, we play victim narratives. Like this has kind of become like, since we have victim politics of, you know, sort of multiple coalition politics, you know, the Civil War and the Democrats moved towards multiple coalition politics. And so you get a lot of that in our major public discourse, and it's set weird frames as it trickles down into the culture. Now people are all sort of using it. And even the right, the powerful, are claiming to be victims because that rhetoric has such strength, and it grew up with such strength in the Civil War. I mean, the civil rights and the women's movement and all these different movements gave it power. So everybody's moving over there to get the power of victimhood. Which makes sense.
Can I ask you, as you know, from your training and your expertise as a rhetorician, like what is your take on the fact that in the past, it seems to me like even only like 5 years that we've adopted this idea that words themselves can be violence. What is your take on that?
I think because words occur around physical violence, it's easy to conflate them. And conflation is one of the big rhetorical challenges in the modern world, where we force two things together and we start assuming they're the same thing. And I think that's kind of what's happened with violence, you know, being imprinted on to words or attitudes. Or, you know, a bad look, you know, you made me feel uncomfortable and that was violence. But again, it's all just trying to stretch that original rhetoric that has power into it over onto your issue so that you can get some stronghold. And what we really need to do is look at the rhetorics that people are choosing to try to get their issue forward. And again, is it the rhetoric you need to get to the audience you want? And I hear a lot of this on the left. I have this argument with my daughter all the time where I'm like, I'm a sympathizer for almost everybody. I'm very liberal. You know, I grew up very working class, so I came from the bottom of a lot of things. I know what it feels like to be an oppressed class and have to fight your way up. Even though I was a white male and I had those things and I got an education, I still know what that feels like. And I can't help not empathizing. I can't stop myself from empathizing with victims, especially of cultural and societal oppression. Because I'm like, that's just arbitrary bullshit. There's just not enough of you to take power in a democratic society. Like if there were enough of anybody, like I've made this argument a few times, there are more women in this country than men. So if women just decided they were a voting block, you know, women didn't have the vote for 250 years or 150 years, however long it was, 144 years. They should just vote. Men don't get to vote for the next 144 years. Like, we're going to balance it out. It's going to be a matriarchy democracy. And they could vote that. Like, democracy doesn't care. There's no morality in democracy. It's just the numbers of votes. So why not set yourself up as a block and just take all the power?
I would love that. Oh, my God. And you guys would like it, too, because you'd get laid more, too.
Hey, you take over for a while. I'm fine. I haven't really done that well with it anyway, so...
Excellente, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That you know, it's one positive outcome of the attacks on women's rights to control our bodies, to defend our bodies against, you know, even if you want to accept the idea that fetuses are people in some way, like we could fully imbue it with 100% of the rights of a 35-year-old man. Like, I don't care if you want to change the Constitution so fetuses can run for president. It doesn't have the right to attach itself to me. It does not have the right to attach itself to me. No one has the right to attach themselves to me.
Parasite.
No one has that right.
Right?
I don't understand why it's so hard. They don't have to be non-persons to not have the right to attach themselves to my body. I have the right to, like, get rid of it. It can go live its life elsewhere.
I've read this whole theory that a feminist, I don't know what year she wrote it, but she said it's always been a woman's right to abort because she needed to protect the tribe, the group. When there were wanderers,
hunter-gatherers. Yes.
And that if she had been sexually assaulted by a male that she did not accept or approve of, she would end up either abandoning the child, burying the child alive, or killing it. And that's always been a woman's right to protect children from male predators in the past. And that's been taken away from us because males now control reproduction, right? They tell us, you're having my baby, and we're whatever.
Mormon is some Catholicism.
They
want to increase the domestic supply of infants. That's what was it, Alito?
Exactly.
They are openly trying to farm us for our sexual reproductive.
Right. I go to the grocery. There's plenty of infants. How many more do we need?
Exactly. But Dr. Jimmy Fallon, head of the neuroscience department at
Dr. UV, Jimmy Fallon. That's his name.
That's his name.
Wow.
It's funny. Yeah. And he's head of neuroscience at UC Irvine. And he said women today are having children with psychopathic men. So you're producing more psychopathic men today. And this is worldwide. And he says this is a bad thing because we have a lot of...
You're attracted to psychopaths?
Or they're forced to have, you know, think of Saudi Arabia. Think of where girls are married.
Ban abortion, like that's... any abortion ban, that is the logical equivalent of allowing rapists to decide when to start families.
Exactly. And Trump is a psychopath. He was president of the United States.
He indicted yet. I heard he was like in D.C. unscheduled, that they came and picked him off his golf
Dump
course.
Around his golf shoes in D.C.
Yeah.
Very weird. Okay, let's not veer too off into abortion because, again, every time you move into this new, you know, farm, like there's just a massive amount of things to
and you're not a woman at. So I understand. Go ahead.
I'm not a woman. It's not my lane. What woman is not my lane. Well, you know, again, sort of looking at it from the theory of what rhetoric can offer to people, it comes back to the same thing. Like people have very strong feelings about these things, and it becomes very difficult to just have a sort of bloodless conversation about the rhetoric or the persuasion of efficiency of it, you know, because you want to get in and, you know, like you're defending real victims here. And I can hear it in all of you guys. Like you are all wanting to defend like a good heroine or hero, or we need a gender non-gender hero term too. Right? Like you've got a feeling of you're doing, this is important. And people are really suffering, and you're trying to use that rhetorically. But you've got to make me feel it somehow.
Okay, let me take a shot
effective.
At it. Dan, you said you had a daughter?
Yes.
Do you mind telling me how old she is?
She's 23.
Okay.
She's old.
Yeah. Can you imagine when she was 13, if she had suddenly come to you and she'd said, Dad,
see, I'm
really
already out.
A boy.
I'm already out. Like, you're not getting me. Let's backtrack, because I know what you're doing now. Like, you're going to try to use my daughter in a, you know, an abortion story or a transition
notes.
Story.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, let's pretend it's somebody. I mean, I don't know what to do with your comment there. I mean, I'm not trying to get you.
I know. I know you're not. I'm just trying to optimize what you're doing.
Well, I think if I were not talking to the master of rhetoric, it probably would have worked, because I think your meta analysis here is to, you know, to instruct your people in anything that comes.
Rhetoricians are annoying. It's
rhetoricians. Yeah. It's all. But listen, I mean, you know, I'll just go with a different thing. Let's just say my daughter came to me and she says, "Hey, Dad, I'm actually a boy." And my first reaction is something like, "Hey, you be you. I love you. I don't, you know, love who you love. I mean, be your authentic self." And then let's say it starts to evolve. And then suddenly it's like, not only am I, but I have to actually make these physical cosmetic changes to my body in order to feel like my authentic self. And then you start to learn that almost all gender medicine, especially as applied to teens and young adults, there's no great long-term research about it. There are a lot of pitfalls that are not discussed openly with young people who are very impressionable and are going down this path. And then you start to imagine, okay, you know, what happens if this is, you know, it's a strong belief, it's a strongly held belief at this point, but what if it is not an enduring belief?
Sure.
And it's right like tattoos. Now, yeah. And there are, you know, I mean, and I'm certainly no expert on this, and Ex-Lancic, I'm not going to put you on the spot, but I think you're better able to address this than I would be. But I do know that the number of detransitioners and desisters who have been trans-identified and perhaps even went down a medical path, who have then gotten to the point of saying, you know, this actually is not authentic to me, and it's time for me to move on. And it creates some very real challenges in terms of, you know, and I mean, the medical challenges, I'll just leave it right there, because I think that's more concretely, you know, discussable. And then I'm sure, I mean, there's a number of, you know, social and emotional challenges that I can't even quite imagine, because I haven't had that experience.
So but that, if I were to, you know, optimize with you, like, I'm not, again, ignore all of this. There's no reason for you guys to absorb this if you don't want to absorb it. But for me, what interests me is getting people to where they can be effective in what they're after. And so, like, if you had a daughter and you had been through this experience and you knew the feelings of it and you knew the timeline of it and you knew the pain of, like, making these decisions and what worked and what didn't, then yeah, I could listen to this story deeply. But because you're giving me a hypothetical, it has, and this is what people end up doing when they're stakeholders. They're not directly involved. You know, they're not the villain. They're not the hero. They're not the victim. They're watching something from the outside, which goes back to my Chappelle story of, I think the man's out of his lane when he's trying to get me to be deeply empathic. And I understand he was trying to, you know, say comedians are also, you know, I get it. I like that part of the argument. He's always explaining comedians to people. People don't understand comedians either. Like, I have a movement called Comedian Americans, you know, because I think Comedian Americans are also horribly oppressed. You cannot be a full comedian in ordinary life. You get fired. You get beat up. You can't say the things that are in your head in normal world. Like, nobody does. So, you know, comedians are oppressed.
We used to. They are oppressed. They used to be able to say whatever the hell they wanted, right or left. Yeah.
So that's my political party, is Comedian Americans. But, like, when you look at that, I'm like, okay, that hypothetical doesn't get me. And the timeline that you talked about that reaches where there are some people that are having problems about this at the end, you know, is that 70%, 90%, you know, maybe a quantified argument would help right there. You know, clearly it's a biological medical procedure. You see this with people getting, I live in LA, and so it's silicone everywhere. I mean, I can't tell you how often.
I can't tell you,
but there are very young girls that are getting this stuff now, or like butt augmentation. I see girls in their 20s in the gym and they've clearly augmented, you know? And so now that's also an issue. And it's the same kind of issue of, like, there's a biological option. There's a medical option for something that's not natural, right? These are not natural progressions. They're medical progressions. So if we look at that and sort of abstract that out as an issue, like, what happens when human beings start to get medical options, medical biological change options? Like, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
With trans in particular, it's a bad thing because these medical options they're being given are being given on the theory that women are men without testosterone, and women are not men without testosterone. Women are women. And so you get issues where organs that you might take for granted as not being sexually dimorphic, like the pancreas, it just doesn't seem sexually dimorphic. It's about the same kind of size, shape, color. It does the same thing, right? But it's very sexually dimorphic in terms of how it responds to testosterone, because men evolved to have testosterone. So all of their organs also evolved to have testosterone, and women evolved to not have testosterone. And so we have all of these things that are in place that are assuming not testosterone. So people are being sold this idea that it's a spectrum, and so shifting along the spectrum won't harm you. But then they're put on testosterone, and, you know, years later they're developing pancreatitis and having to go off of it for that reason.
I think, like, you seem to have a strong expertise on the biological, chemical, you know, side of this, which is really useful, because almost nobody I hear in this discussion area has that.
Yeah, I'm weird. Definitely weird.
No, you're very useful. This is what I was talking about to you, Rose, like when I asked, are you an expert in this? If you're going to talk about a medical biological issue, you probably want that expertise too.
Yes. But I'm an expert in predatory behavior, and I was also an expert witness family court with sexually abused children who I would encounter later, who had a lot of issues with identity, with safety, with all that. But I'm not an expert in transgender. I agree with you. I'm not an expert at that.
But yeah, but that slice of expertise you've got is valuable. I'm not devaluing it completely. Like, that's why I said all these issues get really complicated. It turns out you need multiple expertises. Sometimes you even need rhetoric expertise in order to do good work in there.
You know? Derek is an expert at that. He has the same degree, not a PhD, but he has a master's in communication. So in our podcast, that's what he is. Can I just say something? Solancic, there is Scott Nugent is going to be at the Anaheim convention. Are you coming in October?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
People have asked me. I'm not sure because I'm about to go out of the country and go traveling for about the next 10 days or so to go to a few different conferences. So it might be a bit too wet when I get back. But I might. I don't know. I have a part of my family is down there. So I do go down there pretty often.
I might have to drag Dr. Dan with me to go. He's just down the block for me, so I might drag him there.
So many other lanes. So many other lanes. I don't think I can add another lane.
You just gotta drag your ass there, and you could meet all these people that you say it's only a small number, but I'll show you a large group of people affected by this.
Yeah, I'm not saying, I didn't say it was a small number. I asked whether it was, like, I don't know. Because why? Because it's not my lane. I don't know. I don't know the content at all. What I find interesting, and I think, you know, again, the role I try to play is to help people reach the audiences that they can't reach because they've only got single monolithic rhetorics and they're not ready to adapt. My daughter had this issue. When she started University of North Texas, it turns out to be, it was supposed to be like a little kind of hippie slash public college, but it turned out to be very Christian. And I raised my kids to where, like, I don't even think they knew. They're like, what's this Jesus story? And I'm like, I don't know. Stuff they talked about me when I was a kid. But so she was like getting harassed by some, you know, Christians that had come on campus, older people who were like, you know, you're a whore and you're, you know, and she's like, and she confronted them, and I'm like, did that change them? And she's like, no. I said, did it upset you? She goes, yes. I'm like, well, that was ineffective rhetoric, you know? And she was a communication student. She was actually in Intro to Rhetoric, and the book she wrote was a buddy of mine's book. And I'm like, let's call up the guy who wrote the book, and let's tell him what you did, and we'll see what he thinks. You know, I'm like, I just want you to be effective. I don't want you to be lost in fury, which is what everybody ends up, like a herd of fury. And they're like, I can't get things done. I can't get people to accept. What's wrong with people? Like, well, what's wrong with your rhetoric?
Good point.
It's painful to not just express, you know, but it's more effective to stay rhetorical. Well, it looks like David dropped. We're over an hour.
Oh.
Yeah. The things go quick when there's like four people talking.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he's losing his signal.
No video or audio.
I learned a few things, and that's very difficult for me because I have severe ADHD and no filter. So I say what I think. And what makes me feel confident in an argument is if it's factual. If I can prove, then I'll say it. If I don't know something, I'll be the first one to say, I don't know what I'm talking about. And I usually say I'm talking out of my ass because I don't know. My father used to tell me, if you don't know what you're talking about, shut the fuck up. And I love that because if I didn't know,
Stay in your lane. That sounds like stay in your lane advice.
No, the difference is that I would go and read 100 books.
Is that expertise?
Yes.
Is it?
In my life,
it's not.
Yes.
That's what everybody doesn't understand in the digital space. Like virtual expertise is not expertise. Expertise has to have a lived dimension in order to be full expertise. It doesn't mean you can't say smart things. Like a lot of times when I work, do consulting for companies that are trying to become more persuasive, I talk to the C-suite of CEOs and everything. And I start by saying, look, love that you guys hired me. Thanks a lot. But you all have SPS and it's going to cause problems. And they're like, what's that? I'm like, that's smart people syndrome. And I'm sure you're all smart. You're educated. You can learn things quickly. That doesn't mean you can do your own communication. You can understand it, but I'm going to bring creatives in here who all they do is mess with words. Their brains just do really crazy things with words. That's who you want creating your communication, not you smart people. And smart people end up causing a lot of problems in these issues because they can kind of understand it. They get very fired up. They hold on to some of the expertise, but it's not dimensional enough to really make, you know, the progress they want.
So our expertise, Excellencic, is being women, being born women. I was raped, violently raped at 19 because of my sex, not my gender identity. So I consider myself an expert at being a woman. And I've had gay male friends violently raped by men because it happens to men too. And the common denominator is males. And we used to talk a lot about that in college and high school. So I agree with you. I agree with you, but maybe that will be my rhetoric is I am a woman.
So I think it's a strong starting point for sure.
Yeah.
You have lived experience in that identity.
And I'm black and I'm white. And I'm Puerto Rican.
Yeah. So you got multiple lanes coming together. That's very useful.
There you go. There you go.
Well, super fun, guys. I appreciate it. Again, I try not to stomp on too many landmines outside of my area, but, you know.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. So why don't you pimp your podcast there, Rose?
Yes. Join us so we can hear more from Excellencic because everybody loves her and she's just amazing at the information and expertise at An American Conversation podcast. And we will be live tomorrow with an Aboriginal woman from Australia who's also an activist. So I'm excited about that. Thank you, though. Thank you, Dan, for having us.
Yeah, cool. Enjoyed it. X, do you have a podcast of your own?
So I have a Substack, excellencic.substack.com. I'm also sneaking back onto YouTube because I got the banhammer a while back. But it's been up for about over 3 months now, so I'm optimistic it'll stay up. And that's Isle of X. And then otherwise, my archives are at excellencic.com if you want to see all of my back videos. That will point to the Odyssey. And then I'm on Rumble too. So I'm everywhere.
Yeah, you are.
They can only mass report me so many times. So as right. long as I have a lot of different platforms, I think that will discourage them.
Yeah, that's a viable theory of using the digital space, that weird mixy space. Just find your hacks. Stay alive in the digital world.
Yeah, well, also cool. If you get banned, you need a new device. They definitely device ban.
Yeah. All right. Well, awesome. I appreciate it. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Super fine. Get out there and persuade some people. Do it effectively. Humanity needs it. We'll see you next time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.